This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Okay, it's summertime, and I don't know anyone who's not salivating at the thought of ripe tomatoes straight from the garden.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Rockingham County's Heather Yoder emailed me months ago to let me know that this Saturday from 7 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon is Tomato Fest Day at the Harrisonburg Farmers Market. And to honor this great summertime event, Heather suggested I talk to my Singers Glen country neighbor, Marlon Burkholder, who is, in everyone's opinion but his own, an expert at growing tomatoes.
Well, lots of people grow tomatoes, and there's plenty of people that grow tomatoes better than I do. And I make plenty of mistakes and screw-ups in growing tomatoes, including this year, even though I've been growing tomatoes commercially or for selling purposes for over 20 years. I'm still managing to screw stuff up, and I have things that happen that you can't always explain. You know, it happened to me this year. I suddenly found that 2 to 3 weeks after I'd set out all my tomato transplants, I had tomato plants that were just keeling over and dying on me. And I got to investigating, and they were rotting off right at the soil level. Just looked like something had crushed the stem and rotted it up. And I had no idea what could have caused that. Now, I had a similar situation that happened to me, I expect that's been 10 years ago or more. And that happened, I think, because I went out there and put a bunch of tomato plants into a row that I had first plowed down, a bunch of real tall clover. And then I went in and put a strip of plastic over it, plastic mulch, and right away started planting tomatoes into that. And I had all that clover and stuff plowed under that was rotting up in the soil. And I think there was so much bacterial action going on in the soil trying to rot up all that clover that they had started attacking my tomato plants.
They just rotted up those tomato
plants. So it was rotting the tomato plants too. That was my conclusion then. But now here it is. 10, 15 years later, and I'm having a similar thing happening. And I felt like I had pretty much done everything right as far as prepping the soil well ahead of time. I put my plastic mulch down last fall. I had everything ready to go. I had no reason to expect that anything like this should ever happen, but yet it's happening again.
Do you have a clue as to what it is?
Yeah, I finally decided it was something called Rhizoctonia, which is a fungus that can be carried in the soil. And I don't know why it was there unless it was just a... It was coming to haunt me again. Maybe that's what it was the first time, because I was planting the tomatoes in the same area of the field that I had had this problem before. But it's just one of those mysteries that sometimes pops up, and you don't really know what caused it. But I had to kind of rush out there and buy some Diconil, which is a non-organically approved fungicide, and to spray the remaining healthy plants around the soil line. And wherever I had lost plants, I redug the hole and sprayed down around the hole, and I put a new plant in, sprayed the roots of the new plant. Because that ended the problem. It got them going, but it was a definite setback on this year's tomato crop.
Now, you say you've been raising tomatoes professionally for marketing for 25 years?
Well, I started in 1992 when I got off the dairy farm, and I started going to the farmer's market that summer. I think I put out something like around 125 plants. That was my start.
What plants did you grow? Do you remember?
Well, I was growing a variety of old-time heirlooms and a few hybrids, and it's sort of, I still do that today. I try to get what I think is a good mix of those. I like working with the heirloom tomatoes. They're interesting. Somewhat subtle differences in flavor. You become kind of like a connoisseur of tomatoes after a while.
Well, talk to me about that, Mr. Connoisseur.
Well, everybody has their opinion about what is their favorite
tomato.
Yeah,
but I want yours.
And I don't know if I really have any. I mean, I just like to grow a variety of those old tomatoes, and they all taste good if you grow them right. And
but if you had to be stuck on a desert island with one tomato plant, what would it be?
Well, I would say either a Blosser or maybe one called a Lydia's Orange, which I have come to like a lot better the last couple of years. Maybe a Cherokee Purple.
Describe these. Now, what's distinctive about them?
Well, the Blosser is just a pretty big, about a sandwich size pink slicing tomato. They weigh around a pound a piece. Some will get up to a pound and a half. Just a nice big slicing tomato. The Cherokee Purple is similar to the Blosser, only it's a very dark pink to purplish color, and you slice it, it actually looks a little bit like some of these Russian black tomatoes. I'm growing some of those too. I grew one called Black Ventula last year that has an extraordinary flavor, and I'm growing again this year. Doesn't get as big as a Cherokee Purple, and the Cherokee Purple has a nicer size and a little smoother and doesn't get cracks around the stem end. So I really like the Cherokee Purple, but I like the Russian tomato. There's more and more of those beginning to appear now in seed catalogs and stuff.
I want to get back to those Russian tomatoes, but you said there was one more that you were getting to.
Lydia's Orange. Right. Okay, we had a house fire and burned her house down in 2007.
Sorry for that.
And a number of people from the Old Order Mennonite community responded by giving us some money, and some helped us buy some tools, and one or so gave us some tomato seed. And one of those tomato seeds is called Lydia's Orange. And I planted that thing, and hey, I like this thing. So I saved some seed from a couple pretty nice ones and took them to a couple of local greenhouses and said, here, y'all might want to try this thing. The next year, I go back to that greenhouse, and they've got these plants called Ruth's Orange. And I asked them, I said, well, where did you get this Ruth's Orange? They said, well, it's from that big tomato that you brought in last year. So apparently, I don't know where they got onto the Ruth name, but...
Ruth appropriated Lydia's tomatoes.
Well, something like that. But that's another interesting thing about the heirloom tomato world is there's all kinds of interesting names of tomatoes. Aunt Ruby's Purple Delight. Of course, there's Brandywine. Everybody knows about the Brandywine. Now my brain is not quite. But there's lots of tomatoes out there that have somebody's name attached to it, and usually it's a lady's name. And when you start looking over these things, you realize, well, a lot of these tomatoes are probably the same variety, but depending on where somebody got their seed, you know, it was some relative of theirs that had the seed. But they're all very similar.
I am growing, for the first time, I had a gentleman on the show who told me about mortgage lifter tomatoes and told me the story behind
yes,
that.
Yes, that's a very, very intriguing story. And I grew the thing a couple years, and I was delighted in telling my customers at the farmer's market how this guy had I think it was at a radiator shop at the top of the mountain, or maybe it was the bottom of the mountain, I don't know. But anyway, trucks coming across this mountain would stop at his place with hot radiators, and he would service the radiators, so he got the name Radiator Charlie. Well, as a hobby, he was growing tomatoes in his backyard, and he got to playing around with a couple of different varieties, and he would plant a circle of one variety, and then he would plant another variety in the middle, and somehow he was even doing some hand pollinating of the outside varieties to the middle one, and he developed this thing, which later came to be called the mortgage lifter, and the way it got the name mortgage lifter was that supposedly in the 1930s, during the Great Depression years, he earned enough money from selling plants from this mortgage lifter plant that he paid off the mortgage on his house, and that's where they got the name mortgage lifter.
Well, I like those tomatoes, and I like the story attached to it, too.
It's a fantastic story.
Let's talk about what it takes to grow a good tomato.
Okay.
Please.
Yes. I'll start about the middle of February and plant my tomato seeds, and I plant them in seeding flats so that when they come up, I can select out the best plants to what I call pricking them over into the greenhouse flat that I will grow the plant up to where I'm ready to transplant it out to a garden. Now, most greenhouse producers that start tomato seeds, you know, for selling plants will put the seedling into a small cell, what they call a 48-cell flat. And the flat is 22 inches long and 11 inches wide and holds 48 plants. So each little cell is about an inch and a half wide by maybe inch. Well, it's kind of rectangular. It's 2 inches or so one direction and an inch and a half the other, and it's about maybe 2 inches deep. Well, I found after a number of years, you know, you get your plant up there. It's somewhat root-bound because... Now, you grow a plant for 6 weeks, and by 6 weeks, you know, that thing is getting tall, and you don't have that little root ball on it. So the first thing I started doing was, well, some growers say, well, repot them up as they grow so that they get a bigger root ball. Well, that involves a lot of labor. So I did something called double dirting. I would just take pieces of cardboard and set them in the edges of the flat, and then I would pile more potting soil on top. And so that would make the plant deeper. Well, that worked fine. That helped the plant some, but I still wasn't satisfied. So finally, I started to just put in a little baby seeding. Instead of a 48-cell flat, I put them in a 24. So 24 plants in a flat instead of 48. That means the root ball to start with is twice the size of the other.
It's not just deeper, it's wider.
And then
too.
In addition, I come by when the plants get up about 4 to 5 inches tall, and I do the double dirting and put another 2 inches of soil on top.
Do you prick off the any branches that are growing?
At that stage, no. I'm still in the greenhouse.
You know,
I'm dealing with plants that are just getting up to about 5 inches tall.
Okay.
Where the leaves are just starting to touch each other. That's about when I do the double dirting.
Okay.
And then that gives me a transplant as big as my fist. And I've got a pretty good sized fist.
Yes, you do.
And so...
softball size, I would say.
So you've got a good, healthy, vigorous plant ready to go out to the garden. And I target my planting dates so that I'll have plants ready to go out to the garden by the middle of April, 20th of April.
Wow.
And if the weather delays and I can't get the plants out right away because I've got a big root ball, I can hold that plant another 2 weeks without any trouble. And I can carry them up to 8 weeks.
Now,
if I have to.
At the Singers Glen post office, when I'm in there talking about, have you got your garden in, which is your post office, right?
Right.
Singers Glen?
Yeah.
Everybody says Mother's Day. And here you are going the 20th of April?
Yeah, but you know, you don't go putting tomato plants outside in the field on the 20th of April because you're likely going to get a frost.
Okay.
So I'm leading up to the next thing that I've decided was really necessary if you want to grow good tomatoes. And that's to grow them in a plastic high tunnel.
Okay.
Which is a greenhouse-like structure that you put up out in a garden area, and you plant the tomatoes directly into the ground, but they have this plastic covering over the top, and you can close up the ends. So that allows you to get your plants out in the garden a couple weeks earlier than you normally would. The normal target date for planting tomatoes outside in this part of the country is somewhere around May the 10th, the last frost-free date. I'd like to get some plants out there by April the 20th, April 25th.
This is why
like
you've always got tomatoes before all us other Singers Glenians.
Well, yeah, it helps. My goal is to have ripe tomatoes coming off before the end of June.
Wow.
Normally, we expect to start picking ripe tomatoes around the middle of July, and I want to be picking some before the end of June. And this year, despite the fact I had the difficulty with my root rot on my tomatoes, I still was at the farmer's market. Something around the 25th of June, I had a pretty decent supply of tomatoes that I could ask just about anything I wanted for. So, the key is start your plants early, grow a strong transplant with a good root system, get it out in the garden early, and have ripe tomatoes early in the season.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better. Bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden. Get you a ripe one, do not get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging. Every time I go out and pick me a big one. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life.
Back after a break with more tomato wisdom from Marlon Burkholder.
Money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Homegrown tomatoes, what a life be without homegrown tomatoes. Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
So you were talking about preparing your garden bed correctly. Do tomatoes need any particular preparation?
I have found from past experience that you don't want to put anything on your soil that has excess levels of nitrogen. I've made that mistake a couple times. 1 year years ago, I mulched a tomato patch with a bunch of alfalfa hay, and I had nothing but vines that summer and few tomatoes larger than a tennis ball. And another year, I spread poultry manure on a patch that I planted in tomatoes. And I knew at the time that, hey, this stuff is pretty hot in nitrogen. I don't want to use much. So when I drove the tractor and spreader over the field, I drove it as high gear as I could to spread it thin. But I still got too much poultry manure on that ground, and when the tomatoes grew that summer, they grew extremely fast and high. And then when they started blighting, somewhere around middle July, I mean in a couple of weeks' time, they were just about gone. So by the middle of August, my tomato season was over.
Wow.
And too much nitrogen. They grew way too fast. They were much more susceptible to the blight. I lost the crop way too early. So you want to stay low on nitrogen. Use plenty of phosphorus and potash, particularly potash. And I have always liked to grow them on plastic mulch. The plastic mulch sort of warms the soil. It helps the tomato plants to get off to a good start. And then once they get off to a good start and hot weather arrives, it's a good idea to mulch them with some kind of a hay to actually cool things down. It also protects some with blight coming up from the soil. But the best thing I've found to deter the blight is the plastic high tunnels. And you could walk through those high tunnels, and as soon as you stepped out of the high tunnel, you start seeing much, much more blight. The best explanation I have is that, well, you don't get as much dew on the plants overnight. And if you get that 2 to 3 inch rain, which you sometimes get in the summer, the leaves don't get as wet. It's also helped with cracking of tomatoes. You get a 3 inch rain after a dry spell, and you got tomatoes, and suddenly they got all this water. You start having tomatoes cracking all over the place, and there ain't anything you can do about it. So putting tomatoes inside a high tunnel, you manage your moisture better. You have to use drip irrigation, of course, part of the time. But another interesting thing came up when I started growing tomatoes in high tunnels was we started seeing something called gray wall. You'd slice open this tomato, it would be hard white areas inside that was just tough and leathery.
Uh-huh.
And the tomato really wasn't that good. And I had a tomato consultant explain to me that this is caused by the tomatoes not taking enough potassium, that's potash again, from the soil. Even though you've put plenty of potash in the soil, you've got high levels of potash in the soil, something's causing this gray wall. Well, what is it? Well, they have found out that when you are irrigating tomatoes, particularly if your water is coming from something like a well, which is what my water was coming from, and it's got a hardness of 20 grains or so, and it's got a high alkalinity, 7.2 alkalinity. Water coming out of your well. Well, tomatoes are not happy with high alkalinity. High pH is another way to express alkalinity is high pH. A tomato likes a pH in the range of 6.0 to 6.5, preferably not over 6.5.
So what you do?
So if you irrigate a tomato patch with 7.2 pH water, you're going to get into trouble. And we found that out after a couple years of growing tomatoes in high tunnels. So what is the solution? Well, you can take battery acid and you can put into your irrigation water, which is sulfuric acid. Not very nice stuff to work with, but some producers have done that and have solved the gray wall problem.
Do you do that?
No. I do not want to handle sulfuric acid.
I'm with you.
But fortunately, there is a product on the market called Boraplex, which is an organic-based high-acid additive that you can meter into your irrigation water through a, well, there's different systems. There's things called dosatrons and Matze injectors, which you can set up and it runs a tube down into a bucket with your fertilizer, whatever you want to meter into your irrigation water. And so it works very nicely to put the Boraplex in there at a measured amount and do it about every 3 weeks to a month. And that has more or less solved the gray wall problem. This year we did not see gray wall to speak of in our tomatoes.
How do you water tomatoes? What's the optimal way? Just for, say you have 10 tomato plants out in your garden and you don't have a fancy irrigation, it's you and your hose. How should you water those tomatoes?
You should water a little bit often is better than a lot, not very often.
Okay.
In other words, the idea is to keep a consistent amount of moisture
in the soil.
But you don't want to go from extremes to extremely dry to extremely wet, which if you really slush the water on there suddenly after they've been dry for a while, that's where you get the cracking problem, where the tomatoes, they're growing and they're getting ready to ripen. You put a slurge of water in there, they start growing a lot faster, and suddenly the skin starts cracking. This is particularly a problem with heirloom tomatoes because they have a thinner skin and they're more susceptible to that. Hybrid tomatoes, not as much. You've got a little more forgiveness there.
You know, I do a lot of things wrong when I'm raising tomatoes, but no more. I'm changing my ways. Okay, we're going to get through. We've been picking glorious tomatoes and you have green tomatoes on the vine, and there's the big frost is coming. What do you do with them?
Pick them and get the ones that are the nearest to finishing growing.
Mm-hmm.
They may or they may have not started to ripen a little bit, but you can sort of tell when a tomato has grown to its max, where it's almost ready to start changing color. You can take those tomatoes and you can put them in paper bags.
Ah.
And they will ripen in the paper bag. There's something about the paper bag. There's something called ethylene gas. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm using
that. Paper bag gas, we'll call it.
But anyway, the paper bag holds that gas in there and facilitates ripening if you pick a green tomato. And I've been surprised a few times. Say I'm out there picking tomatoes and I accidentally knock a green one off. And well, that thing's lost. I carry the thing into the packing shed and lay it up on a shelf, and the dumb thing starts ripening in a couple of days. So that's the old tried and true method, you know, in the fall, is to pick as many of those kind of tomatoes, even though they're not quite ripe, put them in paper bags, and you'll get some of them will ripen and later on.
You can extend summer a little.
So you can extend summer a little bit, yeah.
In the time we have left, I want to hear about grafting and other such adventures.
Oh, yeah. I've only known about that for a couple of years. Apparently, they've been doing it over in Europe for a good while. And when I first read about it, I said, you got to be kidding. You know, a tomato plant? Grafting? But, you know, there it is. It's in the seed catalog. They're selling a seed of a rootstock tomato that they recommend to use a rootstock, and they have the grafting clips and everything and even an explanation of how to do it. This looks interesting. I think I'll give it a twirl. So I order me... Well, the first time I tried it, I didn't try doing the rootstock. I thought, well, you know, any kind of a tomato rootstock will work. You just select a tomato that you know is pretty resistant to blight and use that as your rootstock and then take your susceptible varieties.
For example, can you name some names?
Well, some of my hybrid tomatoes, they have, when you look at the seed catalog listing, you see something called VFFNT, sort of. It's a code that describes their resistance to various plant diseases, and the longer that code is, the more resistant it is.
Okay.
V is verticillium, F is fusarium. There's another F in there, I think, which is another race of fusarium. There's N is nematode. T is tobacco mosaic. It's a bunch of different things. A, I think, stands for anthracnose. So you assume that a tomato with a big, long list of that code is more resistant, so you'd select that for your rootstock. Well, for some reason, this code does not list one for early blight. But the seed company that I ordered my seed from did have a variety that they said was early blight resistant, even though it wasn't necessarily in the code. So I got some seed from that. And they said, you know, the flavor is not exceptional. So I thought, well, I'll use that for rootstock. And I tried grafting some heirlooms onto that. And my first attempt at grafting, you know, I used grafting clips, but they were awfully small, and I had waited a little too long to start doing it. My tomato plants got too thick, and so I kind of improvised some things with soda straws, you know, cutting them and clothespins and different things like that.
Any duct tape involved?
No duct tape involved. And, you know, I had a little bit of success. You know, it was about 40 or 50% that first year. One of the things
that seems quite good success for a rookie year.
Not bad for somebody just playing around.
Mm-hmm.
And another key thing is when you make your graft, you have to put the plants in some sort of a healing chamber, which is in kind of a dark area where you have it covered and you keep the surroundings very moist. Set your flats and pans of water and go in there and sprinkle it a couple times with water and keep it kind of in the dark till the graft starts to take. So I did that, and you know, I was sort of pleased with myself. I had close to 50%. But as soon as I put them out to the garden, the first time the wind hit them, they would just break at the graft.
Oh.
And another problem was even the ones that didn't break, it didn't really work that well. So evidently, they know what they're talking about when they say you need to use a selected rootstock. Well, the rootstock that they sell is not an edible tomato. You know, I grew a couple out once just to see what they would be like. And they wasn't fit to eat. But they apparently there's something about that rootstock is that it puts more vigor into your graft when you do it. So I got some of those and tried it again a second year. And that time I had about an 80 to 90% success rate with my grafts. I mean, I had to say, you know, I was successful. But there again, when I put them outside, it wasn't long till they were breaking off. And the people that work with the grafting say generally it's only recommended for greenhouse tomatoes, where you're growing in a greenhouse
environment.
Controlled environment, where year after year after year, where your disease builds up. So that's where the grafting has been successful, and they don't recommend it for field production. Well, I found out those grafts, you can't have wind hitting them because they're not as strong as an original plant. But if you put them in a greenhouse where no wind ever hits them, and you trellis them up like that, yeah, you could probably do it. But I found the way I'm growing tomatoes, it was fun to play with for a while, but it didn't really pay me, so I didn't do it this year. But I had fun playing with it for a while. And
what's it like? How long have you been? You've been at the Harrisonburg Farmers Market?
I started in 92.
And what has it been like? I have to do the math. That's 20 years ago that you started there.
Yep, 20 years ago, that's right.
What's a 20-year career in the farmer's market like? Do you look forward to it? Does it get old?
No.
No.
One of the beauties of farming is that your work changes with the seasons. You're growing different stuff at different times of the year. And another thing, too, is I've got a couple different venues. The farmer's market is only one of them. You know, I do a CSA program. You know what CSA is? That stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It works like a newspaper or magazine subscription. Somebody sends in a check to pay for a year's worth of subscription. The magazine or newspaper starts coming, and they don't know until they get their copy exactly what's going to be in it. You know, the newspaper, it's whatever daily news it is, whatever. You know, it varies from week to week. And it's the same way with the CSA subscription. A person pays for the subscription at the beginning of the year. They start getting a weekly box at a designated time, which for us is about the middle of May, and they get it to the middle of October. And it starts out in the spring. It's a bunch of onions. It's a head of lettuce. It's a half a pound of spinach. You know, it's the kind of things that you're getting in the early spring to start off a season with, a few herbs. Then you get into the middle of summer. You start getting summer squash. You start getting tomatoes. You get some ears of corn. You get beans when they come in. It moves on through the summer, and then in the fall, you're getting garlic and potatoes and turnips and winter squash.
You do know you're making me hungry, don't you?
So the box varies from week to week, but it works exactly like this this newspaper magazine subscription. You pay up your money to start with. It starts at a designated time and ends at a designated time, and they call that CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. So I started that program in 1998, and I've been real happy with it. Before that time, I was going to the farmer's market two times a week, Tuesday and Saturday. I'd go in there on Tuesday. There wasn't very many customers coming through. It would be a slow day nearly every day. And I would do good to sell $100 worth of produce on a Tuesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought after a couple of years of heck with this, I want to do something better. So I started the CSA, and I started off the first summer with 33 subscriptions. I sold them for $300 and something a share. Well, you do the math. That was a lot better already than that $100 worth mm-hmm. of business you do at the farmer's market. So, of course, the farmer's market has grown over the years. I'm selling more stuff at the farmer's market, but my CSA has grown also. We're servicing around 50 customers a summer, and the cost of a share now is $420, I believe, this last year. But I'm doing as much business through the CSA as I am through the farmer's market.
So we need to come on Saturday to see you.
So yeah, I'm only there on Saturday.
Now about that tomato fest at the Harrisonburg Farmer's Market, Saturday, August 11th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Yeah, last year was the first time they did it. They asked producers to submit a tomato, and they would cut them all up in plates and stuff on tables, and people would come through and taste them. And then whoever had the best tasting tomato wins a plaque. Well, I got one for it was a beefsteak, a solid red, big old juicy tomato. I won the category for slicing tomatoes last summer. I'm not sure what I'm going to do this year. I might put something in there. Maybe I ought to try one of my Ruth's or Lydia oranges. I think they're pretty super.
Marlon Burkholder generously shares his vast knowledge of vegetable gardening through his blog, Musings from Glen Echo Farm. You'll find a link to Marlon's website, which has a link to his blog, on the Spark page at WMRA.org, where you'll also find lots of pictures of Marlon and his tomatoes.
So when I die, don't you bury me in a plot in a cemetery. Out in the garden would be much better, so I can be pushing up homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be?
Back after a break with House Call veterinarian Kathleen O'Connor.
Money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.